Welcome to the Agency in Focus SOCOM, sponsored by Leidos. Now, here's your host, Tom Temin.
Air Force Special Operations have a common mission with other services, Special Operations. They support national strategic objectives with carefully delineated applications of force. In an interview, the Chief of Air Force Special Operations, or AFSOC, Lieutenant General Brad Webb explained both the context and the particulars of his operators.
Frankly, our view in SOCOM, and certainly our view inside of AFSOC, is we need to be a full-spectrum force that's ready for the low end of the conflict spectrum from a counter-violent extremist perspective, as well as the higher end of the spectrum to include the great powers competition. So those are the particular challenges that we have faced today.
Now, special forces, regardless of the armed services from which they derive, do certain things that the general forces don't do. When it comes to a great powers competitive situation or counterterrorism that you've been doing, do they do different things in those two different situations?
Well, a lot of it is the special forces or special operations forces more generally receive special training, hence the term, to do a full kind of array of mission sets that can be applied across any and numerous types of mission sets. But you want to generally use special operations forces potentially at a task level, but to achieve strategic ends. And that is really kind of a key that we look for. What is it that is really, you can use a small force at a decisive place in time to have a strategic effect?
All right, let's zero in on the Air Force for a moment. And I think people tend to be familiar with what it takes to become Special Operations Force member in the other armed services. Mm-hmm. Air Force maybe not quite as well known, but I looked at the videos and it doesn't look easy. What do you have to do?
Well, it's certainly not easy. We have what we call battlefield airmen that is part of the Air Force Special Operations Force. They are combat controllers, pararescuemen, special operations weathermen, tactical air control party members that are very similar to the Green Beret, Navy SEAL type of mission sets that you're probably more familiar with. The physical standards, the mental standards, et cetera, are very much the same. So if you were to ask me about those in particular, very, very, very similar. Now, of course, we have a lot of aircraft and a lot of air crew members that are also operators in the Air Force Special Operations Forces as well. And they go through some unique training because we fly unique types of equipment and aircraft as well.
But Air Force controllers, they are people from the Air Force, but they might be with non-Air Force people in special operations.
Yep. They now it depends on the circumstances, but the combat controllers generally are plugged in to Green Beret formations or in the case of TACPs, the tactical air control parties, with the Rangers and the SEALs to provide their unique connectivity between the ground forces and the air component. That is their unique specialty, and so that's how they're generally employed.
So to be a combat controller, it sounds like there's a whole lot of training above the shoulders that has to happen to be able to do that job.
There is a lot of, and it's very specialized training, but with the focal point on the connective tissue between the ground and the air, because they are the real specialists with respect to how do you connect that, because there's so much synergy between the ground component and the air component. They make sure that happens.
And talking about training, AFSOC did this initiative recently to cut back some of the routine training or computer-based training, and I guess the first tactical wing is the group that is experimenting with this. What is going on with your approach to training in general?
The Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Goldfein, has charged all his wing commanders with what he calls reinvigoration of the squadrons. And his contention is, where the rubber meets the road, in any Air Force...
Or the runway.
Or the runway, exactly, where the real action happens, where the real difference occurs is at the squadron level. So he's charged the wings with, hey, what are the impediments to that squadron being more efficient, more effective, and really more lethal and ready? And so the first Special Operations Wing, one of my wings inside AFSOC, The wing commander has really kind of moved out in that. Now, this is an experiment only for his wing. All my wings are doing it. All the wings in the Air Force are doing it, frankly. But this particular wing and the wing commander has been pretty aggressively moving out in the direction that the chief is charged. And so some of the tasks that are better automated or maybe done away with or modified, he's moved out with. And the chief of staff of the Air Force is very pleased with his direction. That's probably what you've been reading about.
It sounds like some of the training has accumulated over the years requirements.
That's right.
That really detract from the training that leads to the readiness that you mentioned.
Right. That's right. And so, he's just taking a look at it with fresh eyes, this wing commander. And really all my wing commanders are. But this one's, has kind of caught the, the spirit of
the zeitgeist.
Media, the zeitgeist of the moment there, and he's getting some attention.
All right, getting into a tactical area to the extent you can talk about it, but I've been reading about the possible jamming of A-130 aircraft, AC-130 gunships, all this jamming. I mean, pretty much every conference you go to that's military, everyone says the next frontier is electronic, and electronic either through cybersecurity or electronic with respect to trying to outdo one another's electronic supporting systems for the physical platforms. Where do you see that all going, in both in terms of defensive measures and offensive measures?
Well, you would appreciate that. I won't go into any operational details of anything that any of our forces are engaged in. But you would expect that we are paying very close attention to any developments, because in the cycle of warfare, there is always new technologies and new counter technologies that occur. And the uniqueness of U.S. SOCOM, and certainly AFSOC being its air component, is that we have a pretty agile, adaptable, flexible acquisition system, and we spend a lot of time and effort intellectually to try to stay ahead of, one step ahead of anything that happens to be evolving. The electronic warfare aspects that you're asking about is a particular area that we have been and will continue to pay very close attention to.
And, the Air Force has a pretty good cadre of cybersecurity warriors that they've been working on over these few years. Are there those that are assigned to special operations forces?
The Air Force has been evolving its communications kind of capabilities over the years, and have aspects of cyber just like the rest of the services do.
But I mean, there are particular networks, particular capabilities, particular applications to special operations that may not carry across all of the Air Force.
To a degree, although the stand-up of Cybercom will kind of focus some of those efforts.
Lieutenant General Brad Webb, commander of Air Force Special Operations Command, interviewed during last month's Special Operations Forces International Conference in Tampa, Florida. I'm Tom Temin.
Leidos is proud to support U.S. SOCOM and its mission to protect America's interests around the world. SOCOM's can't-fail missions can't afford anything less than the latest cutting-edge technology. That's why at Leidos, we develop adaptive and agile solutions, utilizing open systems architecture that rapidly integrates new innovations, ensuring special operations forces have the decisive advantage on the battlefield. At Leidos, we're helping SOCOM achieve mission success today and transform mission readiness for tomorrow. To learn more, visit leidos.com.
Welcome back to Agency in Focus. Next, we hear from Lisa Sanders, the Director of Science and Technology at Special Operations Command. During a recent conference, Sanders talked at length about SOCOM's Futures Project and the innovations expected from it. She explained why it exists and what it looks like, and why diverse and non-traditional thinkers are needed to help SOCOM solve its hard problems.
We don't have all the money to solve all the problems, so we really, I believe it was Winston Churchill that says, now we have to think. We've run out of money, now we have to think. That's where we are, right? So the first thing that we set back and decided that we, in order to think, we needed to provide a framework to think within. Again, not because that framework is going to become rigid, but that it gives us an ability to be adaptable, to be responsive. So that's what this S&T Futures process that we put together, our objective is to create that foundational process so that we can bring the right people together and ask the right kinds of questions, but that the questions that get asked, the people that come together, the problem we're trying to solve may change. That's where the flexibility and adaptability come in. We do start with a mission, but the goal is to allow ideation and brainstorming. So what does that process look like? Let's take the lens of proxy warfare. All right, so before I start with that mission, or even with that mission in mind, when I'm going to ideate on that, I need to bring people together to ideate. And who do I bring together? Well, the first challenge we have is if I bring together the same people that have been designing the next generation body armor and the bullet that goes another 50 feet, I'm probably going to get an ideation that looks just like that. So the first step that we took is to find a diverse group of people to bring together to have that ideation. So we are reaching out to non-traditionals. My first ever LinkedIn article was an article that said, SOCOM wants your help solving our hard problems. And so you can imagine if it's on LinkedIn, it's completely unclassified, right? So I spent, for each of the three hard problems that we put out, I spent a half a page, actually, I'm taking too much credit. I didn't write these hard problems. The people that are in the front of this section, they all wrote the hard problems. But they spent the first half a page making the general population understand what a contested environment looks like, what a near-peer adversary might bring to the table. So we spent the time to set that stage so that we could bring people's ideas into us in a context that was relevant to SOF, but that brought a diverse group of people in to solve the problem. So when we did the first foundry, we call these a foundry. When we actually implement the process, we call it a foundry. The first foundry we did, we had about 4 to 5 different categories of people that came into the foundry and started walking through this process. The first group of people were 7 winners of an Open Innovation Prize challenge. We hung that out on the internet, and we asked a very simple question. We said, identify the technology that has the most potential to impact special operations within the next 5 to 10 years. And we got about 120 white papers. They were a 3 to 5 page white paper with a $1,500 prize. We got about 120-ish white papers from 26 countries. Now, I will tell you, some of those white papers really weren't terribly valuable, but some of them were great. And we awarded 10 $1,500 prizes. And we offered those 10 people the opportunity for another $2,500 to come in and do the brainstorming with us. And so 7 of those 10 people, including people from 2 foreign countries as well as a wide variety of the United States citizens, came in to help us with that process. So that was one category of people. That was just the maker, solver, open innovation network. We also reached into our defense and national labs, but we reached into the deep recesses of those national labs. I challenged the lab directors. I said, I want you to send me the guy that goes home at night and codes and enters hackathons. I want you to send me the guy that works with his high school robotic team. I want people that think differently, that are doers. And so we had about 15 to 18 junior level engineers and scientists and software coders and researchers from the national labs and federal laboratories that came in. I also, through our partnership with Johns Hopkins, who actually helped us facilitate this event, they reached out to the venture capitalist entrepreneur market. And we got people who were very successfully going down the path of flying cars to come in and help us. We got people that were working on communicating through light. We got people that talked about the security of things, not just the Internet of Things, but the security of things. So we had about 10 to 15 entrepreneurs and venture capitalists that came in with us. We also brought in about a dozen operators from a variety of SOF units, from all of our services, from our Marines, from our Navy units, from our Army units, and our Air Force units, and had them engaged in that. We also brought in people from the intelligence community, and that'll be important when I talk about one of the outcomes of this. And then some of our government program managers from our PEOs, our program executive offices, as well as my S&T directorate. And we spent a couple of days brainstorming on problems. So when we do the next foundry, let's say that we had that same type of people engaged in the foundry that's talking about the proxy war. The first thing that you have to put on the table is, what is the strategic desire out of this situation? If it's a proxy war, what is our guidance from National Military Strategy? What is our guidance from our senior leaders in the special operations community? Is this an area in a proxy war? It's probably not going to be a normal rules of military engagement, what we call the theater of active armed conflict. If it's a proxy war, we might not be in a theater of active armed conflict. So one of the national strategic implications is let's not cross the barrier into that. Right? So, but understanding that strategic environment is a bedrock of taking your of working through this process. The next thing that matters is what does success look like in this mission in a proxy war? My success might be different than my adversary's. You can imagine a scenario in a proxy war where maybe what somebody is actually looking to achieve isn't winning in that battle space. Maybe the thing that somebody's trying to achieve is to understand how a future adversary might engage with me. So if that's the adversary's objective, then my objective might be that they don't see how I would, what tactics I would use in order that they to maintain that advantage. So that might be an example for a proxy warfare. If the mission scenario is hostage rescue, you can imagine that there are priorities of mission success. The first priority of a hostage rescue is always to successfully rescue the hostage. Makes sense, right? But then you go down and the next priority is with no loss of allied friendly life. And then perhaps the next tier of mission success down in a hostage rescue might be to be able to capture the hostage takers so that we can interrogate them. But you can see that there's different levels of mission success in any mission that we have. So understanding that when we brainstorm is important, and that's why the operators are a very critical part of this process.
You're listening to excerpts from a presentation by Lisa Sanders, Director of Science and Technology at Special Operations Command. We'll take a short break, and when we return, Sanders explains why establishing the environment is important to ensuring innovative thinking results in relevant ideas. I'm Tom Temin.
Leidos is proud to support U.S. SOCOM and its mission to protect America's interests around the world. SOCOM's can't-fail missions can't afford anything less than the latest cutting-edge technology. That's why at Leidos, we develop adaptive and agile solutions, utilizing open systems architecture that rapidly integrates new innovations, ensuring special operations forces have the decisive advantage on the battlefield. At Leidos, we're helping SOCOM achieve mission success today and transform mission readiness for tomorrow. To learn more, visit leidos.com.
Welcome back to our final segment of Agency in Focus. Lisa Sanders, the Director of Science and Technology at Special Operations Command, describes how the material solutions coming out of the S&T Futures Project are anything but traditional.
The next question is, what is the environment? And the environment can be defined a lot of ways. Some of it is geopolitical. Is this a declared theater of active conflict? Do I have air superiority, as Colonel McGuire mentioned, that we might not in the future? It might be a physical thing. Am I operating in high mountains where I'm not going to have full access because some of my equipment's not designed to work that way? It might be, am I working in a high humidity jungle environment? It could be, is it a city? We talked about the dense urban area. That makes a big difference to our equipment. If you're in a dense urban area, a lot of communications equipment doesn't work terribly well. And it's not because somebody's jamming you. It's just because the physical environment. How many of you have been in a high-rise, corridor and your cell phone doesn't work anymore? It's because you don't have a clear line of sight. So what is the environment that I'm trying to operate in? Only when you have this bedrock and you have the diverse group of people, then you start talking about technology. So what could I bring to the conversation that would achieve the mission objective, that aligns with our strategic guidance, that works in the environment that I'm talking about? And you do it in a brainstorming fashion. It's very much a divergent, convergent thinking. When we did this in the Innovation Foundry, we used design thinking. We had graphic artists with us that were capturing the concepts so that people could visualize how that might play together. And with that visualization, that sparked new ideas. So those are ways that we get after non-traditional divergent thinking that isn't going to give us, I need a lighter body armor, I need a gun that shoots further. Those results that we anticipated and we found fall into three categories. The first category is something that becomes a materiel solution. The good news is that the Defense Department and Special Operations are really good at developing materiel solutions to problems. But the difference in the material solutions that come out of this process is that instead of being the next body armor, it might be I need to develop a artificial intelligence virus that almost does a psychological operation on their artificial intelligence. I probably wouldn't have had that come up as a requirement if I just asked from the bottom up, what do I need to achieve this mission? So it's a material solution, but it might be a different material solution than you would have had if you went after a traditional incremental developmental approach. The second category of things that come out of this kind of a brainstorming session is an area that we've never really focused on before. It's non-material approaches, but many of those are identifying policy questions, doctrine questions, tactical questions. You know, how do you achieve this mission? Generally speaking, when we mission plan something, we start from what we've done before. But when you start this conversation with divergent thinking, people will come up with a very different approach. Some of those policy issues, autonomy is going to be an area where policy is going to really matter. But by having a conversation about a mission, we can actually understand what the opportunities are for using autonomous system and what the risks are for using autonomous system. And then we can also have a conversation about what risk do I have today when I don't take on that non-traditional approach to solving the problem. The outcome of that aspect is what I call my strategic communication. My goal is to have a clear articulation of here is what I can do if this policy allows me, and here's the risk that I take if you don't give me the authority to do that. That's the way to change policy, is by giving a clear use case that shows the risk that I'm taking today that I will not be taking if you give me the authority to do something that I can't do today. All right, the last category is a new problem identification. That's why the intelligence people are in the room, because when you have this conversation with people that don't have any background in the Department of Defense and don't have a security clearance, they are going to tell you what the art of the possible is. And the art of the possible is what those non-state adversaries are using to come against us. So they're going to, things that we think that are beyond the capability of a non-state actor or even a state actor adversary that we're facing, if that gets identified and the people in the room talk about how they can actually achieve that, then that probably means I have a problem I didn't know I had. So that with the intelligence people in the room, we can go out and explore that. We can understand, is this real? Is this not real? And then the other thing that can happen with that is the opportunities get identified there too. Well, I never thought of doing that. So now let's walk through what would that look like. I may need to do new doctrine, but I may just be able to do it today. One of the questions that got asked to me yesterday about the hyper-enabled operator is how long do I think it's going to take to deliver capability under the concept of hyper-enabled operator? Well, if you guys come up with some cool things that are off the shelf, the answer is almost instantaneously. That's an opportunity that I didn't know I had. So that's an example of that third aspect of it. That's way more detailed than some of you probably wanted, but that is the process that we in SOCOM S&T are using to identify opportunities for disruptive technology and to not only identify the problems or the opportunities for today, but be open to the opportunities as they change in the near future.
That's Lisa Sanders, the Director of Science and Technology at Special Operations Command, speaking at a recent Special Operations Conference in Tampa, Florida. You can find this entire episode online. Go to federalnewsradio.com and search
Agency in Focus. I'm Tom SOCOM, sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus.